Come to the 64th annual OA birthday party. Together, we get better. In person, January 12th through 14th at the LAX Hilton in Los Angeles, California. Meet fellows from across the globe for a weekend-long extravaganza of workshops, panels, special interest speakers, entertainment, fellowship, laughs, and recovery. Highlights include body image workshop, weekend-long big book study, sober eating workshop, keynote speakers with unique stories, dance party and comedy show, yoga and meditation, meetings and meetups for LGBTQIA, BIPOC, Spanish language, young people, and AAPI members, plus a boutique where you can shop till you drop. Registration is now open at oabirthday.com. Staying the night? Book your room now at a discounted rate through the oabirthday.com website and act fast because rooms sell out quickly. There is a solution. You'll hear from speakers who have various versions of this disease who live happy, joyous, and free. Because together, we get better.
Welcome to the OA Virtual Kitchen Sink Meeting Podcast. Visit the Los Angeles Intergroup at oalaig.org for information on how to join our meeting live and how to donate to support this meeting and our podcasts. The opinions expressed on the Kitchen Sink podcast are those of the individual speakers and do not represent OA as a whole. And now, our speaker.
Okay, compulsive reader. First, I want to thank you, Frank, for asking me to share. It's funny how this works, right? I haven't shared an OA meeting in a while, and then all of a sudden I get asked here a while back. And then someone else called me and I'm driving Tuesday night to go speak. And then yesterday I get reached out for someone they need to share on Monday. You know, it's like, it like comes in bunches, even though none of those people know each other. It's really kind of interesting how that works. So let me do some details. This is an interesting few weeks for me because this is my birthday run. November 25th is my natal birthday. I just turned 52. November 27th, I celebrate 15 years in a different program. Gamblers Anonymous. December 9th, I celebrated 15 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then yesterday, I celebrated 3 years of continuous abstinence in this program. I am currently down just under 80 pounds, 77, 78 pounds from my top known weight. And I say that because I hit a number on a scale at some point in my life and decided I'm not getting on a scale again until I got back to this program, was actually losing weight. So it honestly, I mean, there's pictures of me out there when I was at my biggest. I'm probably closer to 100 pounds down. I have definitely lost and gained 100 pounds in my life. No question. When I moved out to LA, I was under 190 pounds, just under 190 pounds. And my top weight, again, that I recorded is 300. And that got bigger than that for sure. I just stopped weighing myself. So as you can see, you know, I got 15 years into these other programs. There's a pretty big gap, you know, for this program. And it's not for lack of effort. I will tell you that for me personally, this one is the oldest and the deepest. This was my first addiction. This was the first place I went when I was a child to either hurt myself or comfort myself. Food was always an outlet. And it is definitely something that, like, my parents don't drink. They don't really gamble. My brother, you know, whatever, normal stuff, drinking. He can go and play poker for 8 hours. And he's, you know, he can go to a buffet and eat for 3 hours and then, you know, not miss two meals and have one meal a day. Like, you know, he's 170, 100 pounds, as you know, I think since birth. I hate him. But the weight, really, my parents both have struggled their entire life. So there is some genetics here on that portion of this addiction. I can tell you that, you know, I've been in AA, in OA, sorry, for 10 of those years at least. And I had some years where I had continuous abstinence, but, you know, I would gain and lose 30 or 40 pounds while being abstinent, you know, and I would be one of those people who I would talk when I would share that I was, you know, technically abstinent or that my food was getting a little wonky or a little bigger. And And it honestly, it just wasn't, it really wasn't working for me because I just wasn't being honest with myself. You know, I really wasn't abstinent. I was just able to change my abstinence or play with it or add stuff that fit what made sense. And really, at the end of the day, I was the one just in charge and making decisions. I had a sponsor for many of those years on, you know, different sponsors throughout the years. And I remember distinctly at one point in the beginning, I was doing really well. I was coming to OA. I'd lost 40 pounds. I had a sponsor. I was checking in. I was following a program. I was on a good path. And I just remember at about the 6 month mark, I some people said something to me, offhanded comments. They meant nothing by it. You know, they were just trying to be nice and friendly, but I got in my head about it and got some resentments and didn't feel comfortable in the rooms and stopped coming. You know, and I made it to about 358 days because I was still counting abstinence, even though I wasn't going to meetings and I was still doing my abstinence. And I was at a friend of mine's restaurant and it was right around St. Patty's Day. And they knew I was sober. They made me a non-alcoholic, like St. Patty's shake, you know, normally I would just say no thanks, but of course when caught off guard and our defenses were lower, I didn't even think about it. I just picked up the shake and took a sip. I was appreciative that they thought of me and made it non-alcoholic and, off and running. You know, that was it. One shake, one sip. And I like to say I was the victim of a drive-by milkshake, you know, and from there on, man, it was just on, you know, obviously the weight all came back on and misery came back on. And it took me probably a good year to come back to OA. And then again, I repeated the behavior, you know, I would get a sponsor and do pretty well for a while and then start kind of playing with my food because I just wasn't willing to really fully give myself, which is interesting because my other programs, like 100% turned it over. Like, I just can't do this anymore and I need help. And, a few years ago, I had a little change in my whole deal. I met some guys who were all like-minded, very similar eating issues to me and all 100-plus pound guys, you know, more. And a lot of them had been maintaining. Basically the tenet of that, the basis of this is I fired myself from all food decisions. I don't get to say. Now, I had a sponsor of that who could say like, I'm the attorney. I can present my case for the food, but then my sponsor is the ultimate judge and he gets to decide, you know, what the verdict is. So between that and working with them, I've come up with a food plan that works for me, you know, and it's similar to France. I have three meals and I have two snacks. I abstain from pretty much all flour, and from all recreational sugar as well. And then I don't do deep fried foods and I have certain amount of proteins per meal. So I know there's no guesswork, right? There's no guesswork. I know what I can eat when I can eat it. And if, because I am on the go and I work a lot, I just text either a sponsor or a fellow who has a similar food program to me, say, hey, I'm going to make this change. I don't do the decision myself, even if it's just a protein change, like just so, cause I can tell you by the way, welcome to anyone who's new and welcome to anyone who's struggling. And I can tell you for me, this was such a gift because I was able to just remove the insanity of me trying to figure out what I'm going to eat, when I'm going to eat it, how frequently I'm going to eat it. Where is my meal sexy enough? Is it not sexy enough? Like Frank just said, I send my food in every day before I eat or in the night before. And if there's any change at all, I text my sponsor. Now, the good news is we've gotten so clear on what I put in my body that I know what I can switch and I'll be okay. But even just that, I don't want to give my disease that little edge because it's cunning. It's baffling. It is powerful, right? That we hear about like in the big book. Because even if I change from chicken to beef, even though it's the same amount of ounces, my disease will be like, yeah, see, you got away with something. You didn't have to tell anybody that. And then what's next, right? So I just keep it real clear, real clear. There's just no guesswork because in the first many years of my abstinence, there were a lot of gray areas. You know, I was gluten-free for a while, but yet then I'd go eat a whole gluten-free pizza. Just didn't work for me. It works for some people. Again, I'm not here to judge or, you know, anyone. Everyone works their program the way they work the program. It just wasn't working for me. Like for me to be, when we look at the definition, right, maintaining, either working towards or maintaining a healthy body weight, I would work towards that healthy body weight, but then I wouldn't maintain it. while being abstinent. It just wasn't working for me. So fortunately, you know, this is a disease that for me goes back to my childhood. You know, I mean, when I was a heavy set kid, and it's really interesting because it really wasn't as long as my head tells me it was, but I was a heavy kid. But then when I look back, I remember when Facebook first, yes, I'm old. So when Facebook first came around, I do remember that when it first was developed and people started putting like old camp photos and, you know, everyone was doing all the nostalgia stuff. I was like petrified because people were going to start putting photos of me up, and all these photos came up of me, and I'm dating myself in this too, but I mean, I look like Charles in Charge. Like I was like this thin, I was in great shape, you know, like I was an athlete in high school and middle school. I was in really good shape, but I was still the fat kid in my head. Like and that still has never left me. Like I still have, even though I'm down, like I haven't been able to work out that much. And man, I get in front of a mirror. It took me a long time to be comfortable in front of a mirror. You know, I was the guy who I'd be walking down the street and I'd see my reflection on like a window, and I was just horrified at what I saw, you know, and it took me to a point. And I can tell you that I did not want to come to this program. I was already in two programs. You know, my life was getting so much better, but I was still killing myself with food. You know, I am an addict with food. The first bite, I've identified, you know, all these different things that if I put in my body, it's like, you know, the first sip to an alcoholic. I'm off and running. Like if I put those things in my body, now again, I might not gain 40 pounds in a week, and you know, maybe I'll be able to maintain it for a little while. That's the disease talking, right? But eventually I'm back up over 300 plus pounds. I'm still, even at this weight where it's the healthiest I've been in my adult life, I'm still on a lot of medications, you know, what I call the big guy pack, right? I mean, the party pack for the big dudes, right? It's blood pressure, blood sugar, you know, diabetes meds and triglycerides and, you know, all the stuff that goes along with being a heavy guy. I'm still now the blood pressure as well. You know, they've all come down drastically. And my doctor, you know, I still go to my doctor and get, you know, certainly once a year, if not a couple times a year, and get blood work and stay on top of that. But you know, it's so easy for me to just go back to that life. And I've seen it. I've seen guys who I've known for years, and all of a sudden, you know, you're not seeing them quite as much as a meeting, or you're not hearing from them as much, or that, you know, and then next thing you know, they come back in 9 months and they're, you know, 60, 80, 100 pounds up if they can make it back. Some of them don't make it back at all. And some of them don't make it back for years, you know, and that for me is a healthy fear. I have a healthy fear of this disease. Sorry, my dog's getting a little agitated. I'm apparently not paying her enough attention. I have a healthy fear of these diseases, you know, and it's interesting because when I got here, I knew what alcohol and drugs would do to me. I knew what gambling did to my life. I knew what food was doing to my life, but man, I just was not. I was so willing to turn over my drugs and alcohol and gambling to my God, to my higher power, right? But I wasn't letting God handle my food. You know, that's my territory. I can handle my food, right? So, you know, there's a difference between belief in God or higher power and trust in that higher power. Trust that my higher power can handle the wheel. And I'm going to tell you that when I first got here, you know, I had all kinds of issues with God and what I thought was a religious aspect of this program. It wasn't that I didn't believe in God. I was angry with God. Growing up, you know, I'm Jewish. Nowadays I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish. And, my family, you know, we weren't ultra religious, but you know, when I was younger, I had a pretty strong belief in my faith. And then I lost some people close to me, like a friend of mine in eighth grade died of leukemia. I was a freshman in eighth grade. One of my friends drowned. And then my grandfather had Alzheimer's, another grandfather had a stroke, and my aunt, unfortunately committed suicide. And like, you know, I really got angry with God. And it's interesting when I kindly when I got to be in my early 20s, I kind of said F you to God. And when I look back, when I got in these programs, and I look back on my history, that was a distinct fork in the road for when my addiction started to kind of take hold. You know, the gambling really picked up, and then alcohol consumption, which I really wasn't a drinker. I really barely drank or did drugs at all through high school and college. And then that started poking up more. And then obviously the food started getting out of control. And that was a 10 plus year run of spiraling out of control and devastation that, you know, was leading me to death. There's no question. There is no question. Or jail, right? Or death and someone else's death in jail, driving drunk, you know, and eating myself to death. And I mean, it was such an incredibly horrible way to live, you know, but I was a survivor like many of us are, right? And I did what I had to do to survive. And I can tell you, let me get to some recovery here. You know, what these programs have done for me in my life, like I can't, it's hard to even explain in words. Like my life is so unrecognizable. I mean, I was a people pleaser to the nth degree. And now I'm for the most part, like I still have my days, right? I'm comfortable in my own skin. Like I don't need you to validate me, but I have incredible, incredible friends, true, real relationships. When I got to these programs, I knew a million people. I was that guy at the bar that I was like Norm, you know. I walk in, cheers, and my drink was waiting for me, and I knew everybody, and I was this big, it seemed like this big fun. Like I remember a lot of my friends couldn't believe when I started getting into these programs that I had problems. They were like, really? Like with it? I mean, you didn't seem like you had that big of a problem, you know? But I was the loneliest guy in the room. You know what I mean? I would go there because I needed that. I needed to feel that love. And it took me a while, but through this program and through working the 12 steps, right? I urge you, if you're in this program and you don't have a sponsor or you're not working these steps or you've never worked these steps, or maybe you've been around a while and you're going through some stuff to rework some of the steps. Because, you know, we come here and it's a 12-step program. And unfortunately, so many people just don't take advantage of what that has to offer, right? Stopping eating for me is the beginning, and it's where I have to begin, because all roads for me lead back to the food. All roads for me, any, for any reason, because something good happened, because something bad happened. My mind wants to go to the food, right? But just abstaining from food behaviors or whatever other it is just the beginning of what these programs have to offer. A progressive character change, a growth in yourself and a right sizing of our ego where, you know, I was like this guy who had this huge fake ego out top because I felt so horrible about myself on the inside. It was like the battle for Middle Earth, right? It was like this huge overinflated ego that was fighting with this incredible, horrible feeling that I wasn't good enough. And I had to just to feel equal. And when I got here by working these steps and doing the inventories and being sponsored, then eventually sponsoring people and being of service and getting out of my own way, right? And learning how to be really work for others. And the beautiful thing is it's what I like to call a selfishly selfless program, right? Here, we only get better by helping other people, but then that also helps us. So in a way, it's selfish because we're doing it for us, but we're also helping other people. So it's just a beautiful way to live, right? I can really only better myself by helping other people. It's really hard for me to really grow as a human being without being of service to those around me. And now that service takes many different forms, right? It could be sponsoring someone, but not everyone feels comfortable sponsoring. It could very well be, you know, like, you know, Frank taking service commitments on Zoom or in live meetings. It could be putting chairs away. It can be just picking up a phone and calling a newcomer. But getting out of self was such a gift for me because all I did was think about myself all day, every day. And I hated myself. Right. And that voice, by the way, is still in there. That voice, that fat kid who tells me what a piece of shit I am, pardon my language, right? That I'm not good enough is still in there. And that's why I have to continue to show up and continue to sponsor people and continue to be of service and continue to do these things that have put me in this place to live a good life. Because at the end of the day, that's all to me, that's all these programs are. what this program is a tool set. It's handed me a tool set to be able to live life on life's terms in a world that I'm not capable of doing. My natural state is addiction. Now, it took me a while to really be a full-blown addict. So there's people who are in different, it's progressive disease, right? But when I got to the point where I was a full-blown addict, I couldn't deal or cope without some form of an addiction, drugs, alcohol, gambling, food, at the time, cigarettes, whatever it was, right? And today, I don't have to hurt myself over those feelings. I can still have those thoughts. I can still have a reaction to the world, but now I have a tool set to be able to deal with it and get through it and actually usually grow from it, from the experience. If I apply these tools, I know that if I continue to do the things that got me to where I am today, I'm going to be okay. What an incredible blessed feeling to know, even when it doesn't feel like it. I'm going to be honest with you, this last week or two, I've had a lot of anxiety, and I'm, you know, when I'm years into a lot of these programs, you know, work anxiety, and it's, by the way, it's all good stuff. You know, that's my head tells me, you know, I get a phone call from my boss and my immediate reaction is I'm getting fired. You know, I've been one of the top people producers at my job for 14 years straight. And that's still that fat kid in there telling me I'm not good enough. You know, the good news is I don't have to believe everything that goes in my head today. And I certainly don't have to act on it, because before I did, before I was actively acting on those thoughts in my head that I was a piece of crap, you know, that the world revolved around and I didn't deserve it. And so F you, I'll show you, I'll hurt me, right? I mean, I know it's a cliche, but it's just so true. So if nothing else, if you're struggling with how this program works, I can't tell you exactly how it works. I just know it does if we work it, right? We have to put in the effort and we have to be consistent, because, you know, I've in these programs, I've had a sponsor who had, you know, 20 years in one program, 17 years in another, and then ended up going out, you know, because he got away from the tenets of what we do here, you know? So that's why we say there's no cure. It's not a cure. I have to continue to be diligent and continue to do these things. But I got to be honest. Yeah, there's some days where I don't want to go to a meeting or things like that. But what this program has given me is such a gift. It's so incredible. Why wouldn't I want to do it? You know, if this is what it takes to be able to live the life I'm living, so be it. You know, that's amazing. And I think that's my time. Let's start with Don.
Thank you, Jeff. That was great. The question I have is, you talked about how you're the attorney and your sponsor is the judge, but could you just explain on a sort of practical day-to-day basis? I mean, how you ask and get consent or get a ruling on your food?
Sure. So a lot of that definitely happened in the beginning when we created my food program. So it's actually interesting. I had a couple of sponsors in this kind of 3-year run. My first one went out. My first sponsor, like, all he ate was protein and veggies. So, and obviously, you know, that was going to be a tough one for me to do. But what he did with me though was we actually stripped me down to just protein and veggies in the beginning, and then we added back like one food at a time, just so I could really get an idea of where I had kind of the allergic reaction, right? What would trigger the obsession of the mind to want to keep eating? So that helped. Now it kind of looks more like, you know, hey, for my snack, you know, I'd like to add a cheese stick with a piece of fruit. And my sponsor will talk to me about that. What does that look like? Where is that coming from? What, you know, it's not just a yes or a no. Like, we actually have a discussion about why do I want to do that? What do I want to add? Or, you know, I'll also, from subtracting, I'll say, hey, you know, I'm thinking maybe this feels like it's triggered me a little bit, and I'm not just going to remove it without, you know, talking to my sponsor as well. So in the beginning, it was kind of like my sponsor suggested, you know, I eat 4 ounces of cut fruit. And I was like, well, that's not a lot of fruit. How about 6 or 8? You know, so that was the negotiation, right? So we can negotiate a little bit. We've identified what the issues are. So we're okay with that, but let's talk about, you know, how much protein. And then there was a point where, you know, I was originally doing 10 ounces of protein per meal. It's a lot of protein, you know, but I'm a bigger guy, so it was fine. And then it got to a point where I was kind of plateauing a little bit, and it's a lot of just decent amount of protein. So then we had a discussion and we cut it back to 8 ounces of protein. You know, so things like that, where it's just an open dialogue and I'm presenting, you know, hey, I want to, I'd like to eat frozen yogurt. Right. I can bring that to him. Doesn't mean he's going to agree or say yes, but we're going to have a conversation about it. Right. Things like that. It's just an open dialogue where, and then ultimately he makes the decision and then I stick to it. So that's where the lawyer or judge comes in. Right. I'm presenting the case, but he gets the final ruling and then I have to abide by it. Does that make sense? Great. Bob M.
Thank you. Bob, compulsive overeater. Thank you very much for your incredible share. Do you have a daily routine? And if you do, what is it? And can you describe it? Thank you.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I'm glad you brought that up because my daily routine has not been as great recently and I need to get back to it. But yes, for years and years and years and years and today, when I wake up, the first thing I do, because usually my fiance is either gone before me or she's up before me because she's a nurse. She gets up early. First thing I do, what I was taught here, was make my bed. So that's the first thing I do. And, you know, ironically, that was one of the biggest things that showed my mom that something had changed in her son, because for 36 years of my life, I never made my bed. Never. And I was home visiting my first 8 months of recovery and my mom peeked in my room in the morning after I got up and saw the bed was made and it blew her mind. She knew something had changed in her son. So that's one. That's every day for me. Second one is, and I actually personally, because I take a shower pretty quickly after I wake up, before I walk my dog. The shower for me is also because I have a lot of physical stuff going on. So it's really like a meditative thing for me because it helps loosen me up. And I actually do prayers in the shower. I say the third step prayer. I say the seven step prayer. I will say the serenity prayer. I then pray to be of service to others. And if I'm having some anxiety or anything like that, I pray to have that removed. And also just to, you know, to help people and to be conscious and, you know, I'll do some other prayers for, you know, whatever's going on, world peace or, you know, for health for other people, if it, you know, God's will be done. And then, the part where I've been slacking, those I do every day. And that helps me, you know, I heard a guy speak in an AA meeting once. He said, you know, when I wake up, I have to get to God before my head gets to me. So I take that into account. And then I had another sponsor that would say, you know, we wake up 12 steps behind everybody else. So that's those things I do every morning. What I haven't been as good at is I used to do little daily readers and I have, you know, an OA one, I have an AA one, I have a G, I have like five or six of those. It takes me 5 minutes to do those, even though it's a lot of them. So I, when I do that, I'm even in a better headspace. There's no question. And that's been a little slacking. So I do that every morning to get my day right. And then throughout the day, I kind of do spot check 10 steps. Like if I did something or said something, I would then go make an immediate amends. And then at night when I take just a quick look, but I'm also constantly reviewing my day. So I don't just do it at the end of the day. So I just kind of live in these steps, you know, so I don't always necessarily do like a sit down written 10 step at night, like some people do, but I think it's a great practice. And that's pretty much my routine. So, and then I, you know, obviously I sprinkle in meetings. I sponsor a few guys. So I get calls from them and sometimes I'll go meet them for a lunch or dinner, et cetera. So that's all part of it as well. Deb.
Eric, did you want to ask a question
Eric, sorry.
He kind of covered mine a little bit, but it was basically how do you use your, you know, spiritual relationship or your higher power in difficult situations or, you know, when your anxiety comes up and things of that nature, but kind of covered that right then. So I just wasn't sure. So.
Yeah, but it's, you know, but it's a good thing to deeper dive on because, you know, I think sometimes we forget to, I'll really speak for myself. Sometimes I forget to go to that. You know, it's not always, it's still not natural for me, even though it's such a huge part of my life today. So, I do a lot of times, you know, praying and turning this over or turning the problem over or turning the anxiety over. Sometimes it works immediately. Other times it doesn't. Right. But I know if I keep doing it, eventually I'm going to be okay. Like that's just an overwhelming mantra I have in my head. I will be okay. As long as I continue to do what got me here, I've been through this stuff before. I know it's not permanent. You know, we have this saying, this too shall pass. Right. So I continue those daily practices. and eventually it's going to break. It doesn't always feel good. It's not always comfortable, but the alternative is for me to go eat my way through it or do the other things to get my way through it. And while that may give me temporary relief, we know in the short or long run, that's going to end up killing me and taking me back to misery and making it even worse. So I, you know, God works best in the valleys, but it's also, I got to remember to use them in the high peaks too, because it's just a practice to routine. So I don't get too full of myself or too self-deprecating either way. Deb B.
Thanks. Thanks, Jeff. Deb, food addict. Beautiful, beautiful share. So you had talked about character change. What about the character change in relationships? You had mentioned you have a fiance. So I would love to know, peaks and valleys of the character change in relationships.
You know, really in all relationships. I had an incredible sponsor, and Frank was very close with him as well. I was also Frank's sponsor, and you know, for a while. And he told us, he had this one famous quote, and he had a lot of them, but one of them was, in relationships, we're doing one of two things. We're either empowering the other person or we're diminishing the other person. And, you know, for a long time, when it comes to friendships, even, you know, it was lower companions, right? And seeking out people who maybe I felt good in the moment around or, you know, and I can tell you that one of the greatest gifts, because people pleasing was as big of an addiction to me as any of my other addictions. Like I collected human beings to make me feel better about myself. And fortunately, some of the really good ones have stuck around, you know, both in program and out of program. But you know, the days I stopped going to the places where I hung out, 99% of those people went away. Right. And, I wasn't really capable of being in a loving, giving relationship because I didn't love myself. So it took me, I really took it very seriously. I stayed out of relationships for quite a while in the first few years of my recovery. And I really worked on myself. And, I've had some great sponsors on the way. And one of my sponsors early on would say, you know, when I'm ready, she will appear, you know, and it's not going to be the one I want. It's going to be the one I need. And, you know, sure enough, I actually, you know, I met my, now we've been engaged for 8 years, so I still call her my fiance, but we've been together for 10, but I actually met her when I came back to OA. She had several years abstinence in OA from a different form of this disease. And, I was new, but she was a little newer in one of my programs and I had time in that program and, you know, and we hit it off. We've been together and we have a beautiful relationship. We hardly ever argue. And we filter our relationship through the 12 steps of recovery and through the 12 traditions. And, she actually had an OA sponsor. I don't know if any of you guys know, Jay Westbrook. If you ever heard him share, highly recommended. If you ever hear him share, especially if he's sharing on the 12 traditions and relationships, he actually takes the 12 traditions and then each one is like a different step in a relationship and how you apply it to your relationship. Super cool. It was like a really cool way to look at stuff. So yeah, I mean, I'm a better human being. So I attracted a better human being, you know, I'm in recovery. So I attracted someone. I wanted to be with someone who's in recovery because to speak the language and to understand that, hey, yeah, tonight I got to go to another meeting. You know, I got to go meet a sponsee. So it's really an incredible way to have a relationship. It's beautiful. So Franklin.
Hey, Jeff, thank you so much. What a great, great share. And, so I want to talk to you about service because, I mean, you're one of the people that reached out to me early in recovery in my other program. And although we haven't been all that connected service wise, meeting wise, even in this program, I'm well aware of how important service has been and is in your life in your other programs. And for me, and I'm asking this question because, I do a lot of service in my other program and I do kind of token stuff in this. You know, I'll take on some positions like this, maybe a tech host or background sort of stuff. And that's important to me. Now, I do have a sponsee and I have another food sponsee. I don't do a lot of outreach calls in this program. And how important is it to do service in this program, and how does it compare to how you do it in your other program?
Well, first of all, don't belittle what you just said, because it's still service. Service takes many different forms. It takes a lot of people to put on a meeting like this. So not all of the service, you know, things we do here are we're getting a pat on the back for, right? Or we're out in front, or we're getting seen, right? There's a lot of different ways to do service. So don't belittle anything you just said. Doing the Zoom or running a meeting or doing the behind the scenes is as important maybe as picking up the phone and calling people. For me, typically that is my first and foremost though, because I like to welcome the newcomer and make them feel welcome, and because it was done for me, you know, in my other program. So I learned from that. It's funny. I'm kind of the opposite though. I probably do way more service in the other ones than I do here. Well, I mean, I'm not the opposite. You said similar thing, but like you're still doing service here. I do actually though. I am on text threads with a bunch of guys, several different ones. A lot of them are newer. I think the most time anyone else on their thread has is maybe a year. And then the other guys, a lot of them are struggling in and out. And we do like a little text thread on a daily basis of, if we were honest and absent the day before, we just send a 100 on the text. And then like yesterday, one of the guys reached out because he was having a moment where his food suddenly had to be switched and he couldn't get help with sponsor. So I was able to pick up the phone and call him. And so things like that, you know, but I think all service is important. I think it is crucial to do some kind of service if you're not, whether that is just picking up the phone and welcoming someone or calling someone, or even doesn't even have to be a newcomer. You know, it could be someone who's been around for a long time and checking on them and seeing how they're doing and keeping that connection. Those are all service, right? And I will tell you that someone early on said, you know, it's not service if it's not inconvenient. I don't agree with that, because I think there's, you know, I think there's some stuff that, you know, whatever it is, I don't care what it is. It goes back to my selfishly selfish thing, right? Which is, we're doing this here to save our own lives first and foremost. But so many of the things we do here also help save other people's lives. So it's all service to me. I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's throughout the day. If you see someone who's struggling to open a door, you go and help them open the door, right? That's service. You know, you see a coworker struggling with something, you go and help them. That's service. We can take these steps and apply them to our everyday lives as well. It doesn't have to be just in these rooms. There's, you know, we can go volunteer in organizations outside of 12 steps, right? There are so many different ways to do service. So I don't belittle any service. You know, I just think it's really important. And what we've also found, I know Frank, you can attest to this, is for those of us who engage, the more service we engage in, the better shot we do really have of staying here. You know, like, I know there's guys who, you know, got a service commitment or a 6-month service commitment to be a leader of a Zoom or an in-person meeting. And, you know, they're almost ready to go out before they got that. And that kept them around for 6 months. And then they heard enough of the message to get them to stay. And then they got a, you know, so really, really important. Service is kind of the lifeblood, the backbone of all these programs.